This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. When it comes to socializing, is your battery bursting with energy or feeling drained? Do you thrive around people or do you need more alone time? It can be easy to spread yourself thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, strengthen your self-confidence, and much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/heartwisdom today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/heartwisdom.
So I said, oh, Joseph, you know, I just adore you. I'm sure you have an intuitive sense of what I should be doing, so just tell me what to do. And Joseph said to me, the Buddha's enlightenment solved the Buddhist problem, now you solve yours.
The Buddha's enlightenment solved the Buddha's problem. Now you solve yours. Wow. Some fierce, fierce Dharma from amazing Joseph Goldstein. Jack's really good friend and Dharma brother for their full careers. So welcome back. This is episode 205 of Jack Kornfield's Heart Wisdom here on Ram Dass's Be Here Now Network. Truly a blessing to be with you all here once again. This episode is titled Solving Your Own Problems, and it is all about empowerment, personal understanding, spiritual awakening, and learning to trust yourself. This episode features Trudy Goodman, Jack's beloved, who I'm sure you know if you've listened to Be Here Now Network over the years or are familiar with Ram Dass's the group of amazing teachers around him. Trudy is a Vipassana teacher and a truly vulnerable, sweet human being, I know from personal experience. And joining them is Dr. Bonnie Duran, a professor emeritus at the Schools of Social Work and Public Health at the University of Washington, and somebody who has dedicated the last 35 years of their life to helping Native American, Indigenous peoples, and peoples of color. And the reason for the coming together of this Dharma trio is to share stories of their teachers, the individuals, the upagurus on their path who are able to spark something in their hearts and ignite that flame to help them go ever deeper into being the people that they are now, who are so centered, who are so loving, who are such in service, and who are so dedicated to sharing that same light that was given to them. And they do this in a way that is truly hilarious. I don't know if I've laughed so much in a podcast in a while. So this is a really entertaining one and one that really shows the power of stories. Which brings me on to my last topic before we wrap up. Jack is offering a 10-hour journey of his most favorite stories that he's ever shared throughout his teaching career. This is called Transform Your Life Through Jack Kornfield's Most Powerful Stories. Jack has chosen the stories that he's shared throughout the years that have brought people to a deeper intuitive sense of themselves and the universe, and has packaged them in a way that creates a true journey of being. If you sign up before September 28th, you will be able to join Jack in 2 live question and answer sessions with the student body, where you can dive a little deeper into the stories that you've been listening to and figure out what Dharma nuggets work for you and can be applied to your life in a way that helps transform you and those around you. There's something very special about the transmission of stories into the heart, and that kind of whimsy can be shared very easily with the world. So I implore you to sign up for this amazing course. You can go to jackkornfield.com into the courses section, or you can just go to this Be Here Now Network webpage or the podcast app page that you're on right now and click Transform Your Life Through Jack Kornfield's Most Powerful Stories, as I've tossed that link in the show notes. So there we go, y'all. I hope you enjoy this amazing podcast with Trudy Goodman, Dr. Bonnie Duran, and Jack Kornfield as they share stories of their teachers that helped transform their lives. May you be well, may you be happy, may you help others through the authenticity of your own being, and may your heart smile. Namaste, y'all.
I'm going to start to tell you a little bit about my Dharma story and a few of my teachers and the impact that they've had on my practice and on my life. So I first met the Dharma in 1982, almost 30 years ago now. I was a student at San Francisco State University, and I graduated from college in 1979, I think. And I had been really involved with the American Indian Movement and Civil Rights Movement on the campus. And I thought after I graduated, you know, I was a first-generation college student. And I thought, well, I'm going to do what all the white kids do. I'm going to go to Europe after I graduate from college. So I decided to do that, but of course, I didn't have any money. So I bought a one-way ticket to Europe, and I got a job over there. I was very lucky. I found a wonderful, actually, place where a lot of expatriates lived in Germany. It was a little German resort, and I lived there, and a lot of the people there were going overland to India. All of these people were going overland to India because that was really the quest back in the day. And I, you know, missed going overland by a year because the Ayatollah Khomeini came into Iran. So rather than going overland, I actually flew over. But I had been in Europe for about 3 or 4 years when I landed in India, in New Delhi, and then flew up to Kathmandu. And one of my expatriate friends in Germany had said, the best way to go to Asia is to start off in a monastery so you can get really acclimated to Asia. So I ended up going to a wonderful monastery right outside of Kathmandu, Nepal, actually where Lama Tupten Yeshi was the abbot, and his student or his protege, Lama Zopa Rinpoche. And I'm sure many of you probably know those wonderful Tibetan teachers. And so I, you know, checked myself into the monastery, and it was so wonderful because here I had done, you know, hung out with a lot of Indians, American Indians, and I saw all of a sudden all these Tibetans. And, you know, they were there with the turquoise and the coral and the braids. I really thought I had come home. It was really wonderful to be with Tibetans after being in Europe for 3 or 4 years. So, and they were really excited to see me. They couldn't believe I was an American. So what they would do is they would dress me up in a chuba, which is a Tibetan dress, and then they would take me around to all their friends and say, okay, say something. They would say, can you believe she's an American? So that was it was a delight for both of us that we discovered each other. It was a wonderful time. So anyway, I started this November course. I actually entered the November course of Kopan Monastery, that's right outside of Kathmandu, with these two wonderful lamas. It was a place where they taught, you know, young Tibetan boys how to read and write and the Dharma. And so I started this November course, and, you know, I didn't know anything about Buddhism, and, you know, I'd been raised a Catholic, and I wasn't really sure, you know, I heard it, you know, and I thought it was really great. But I wasn't, you know, wasn't really totally convinced yet. I still had a little bit of doubt about the Dharma. And so, you know, I had been there maybe 2 weeks, and Lama Zopa said to all of us during one of the teachings, and I swear he looked directly at me when he said this, but, you know, you never know. He said, sometimes you can have a realization of emptiness during a dream. And then he just went off and, you know, talked again. And of course, you know what happened. That night I went to bed and I had a really deep understanding of emptiness through a dream. You know, when I had left Garmisch-Partenkirchen in Germany, you know, I had left behind a boyfriend and a lot of pseudo family or instant family. And I had this dream that all of the sadness and loneliness I was feeling from not being with my family and my boyfriend was totally internal to myself. It had absolutely nothing to do with the situation. I really understood that there's nothing inherent in any situation that determines how you're going to feel about it. That's all a result of what we bring to it, our sankharas, or our habitual way of thinking of things, our habitual attachments. And I had a really deep understanding of that. And of course, I woke up the next day and just had a huge amount of faith. And I hadn't, you know, Tibetan Buddhism is so beautiful. They have the wonderful bowing. And I hadn't bowed yet in that whole hall. You know, there was 100 people in this beautiful gompa. And I was one of the very few who hadn't bowed. I was on the floor that next morning. And it was a wonderful experience just to bow too, because all of a sudden, all of my, you know, a huge amount of ego and selfing that I didn't even know was there was just thrown in my face. So I really do think that sometimes these ritual forms can be really useful, not so much as, you know, rote way of honoring, but really to come to understand something about our relationship and ourselves. So that was one wonderful experience I had. And then I'll tell you about another teacher who I adore, who's one of my root teachers, and I had the exact opposite experience. So after I was in Asia for about a year, and I came back to the United States and tried to get into the Tibetan Buddhist scene here in the United States, but it really didn't really have a place for me. It was mainly, you know, I'm going to be honest here, it was mainly, you know, European Americans, and the only people of color who hung out there were the one or two teachers that came over. And I don't know if everybody there had money, but I didn't have any money in there at that time in the 80s. They didn't have a lot of scholarships, so I wasn't able to attend a lot of the retreats. So I practiced on my own. You know, every vacation I ever took was always about meditating. I would find cheap retreats or would just figure out a way to spend my vacation in intensive practice because I really loved it. So one year, I found my way to Vallecitos Mountain Refuge. I'm sure some of you here know it. It's a wonderful, you know, wilderness ranch. Can't get a cell phone signal, which is really great. And I attended a people of color retreat, which was really wonderful. They had only about 20 or 25 yogis. And it was taught every year by Joseph Goldstein. If you can imagine, Joseph Goldstein and 20 yogis. It was really nice. So, and I had, of course, knew who Joseph was. I actually had even seen him when I was in India. I was sitting at a retreat that he sat. And I said, oh my gosh, there's Joseph Goldstein. And so I was so excited to be sitting with him and to have him as a teacher. You know where this is going or what? So anyway, my first interview with him, you know, I was so excited and I had come out of the Tibetan tradition. And, you know, we sat down and told him how I was doing and everything. And at the end of the interview with him, I said, and, you know, I was used to the Tibetan tradition of guru devotion. So I said, oh, Joseph, you know, I just adore you. I'm sure you have an intuitive sense of what I should be doing. So just tell me what to do. And Joseph said to me, the Buddha's enlightenment solved the Buddhist problem. Now you solve yours. Which was the exact opposite of what Lama Tupten Yeshe had done. But they were both absolutely perfect teachings for me at different times of my life. So those are my two stories that I wanted to share with you. And I really, you know, I was talking the other night about my excessive faith. And my excessive faith, I have to say, I understand it more as just a huge amount of confidence in the Dharma. I have no doubt that the only way that I'm going to solve any of my problems is really through the Dharma and through through awakening wisdom. So that's where my big confidence and my big faith is. And just a few days ago, Christopher Titmus posted this message that he got from a friend of his. A friend of his is a Buddhist scholar, a sutta scholar, and had been looking through the suttas for descriptions of the life of the Buddha. What was the Buddha's life really like? I mean, what was he like as a person? You know, he's our ultimate teacher, right? He's our root teacher, the Buddha. So this guy named Stephen Karpik wrote this email to Christopher Titmus and telling him about what the real life of the real Gautama Buddha was like. And this is what he said. Stefan wrote to Christopher Titmus and said, I have a sense of a person who had backaches and wanted Ananda to teach for him. Made a teaching mistake on the foulness of the body, causing his monks to commit suicide. Could not be bothered with fractious monks. Was a great walker. Loved hanging out in nature. Was a superb debater. Had a brilliant sense of humor. Was about the earliest satirist. Didn't want the bother of teaching, and then overreached himself by trying to impress the first person he saw after enlightenment, and he failed. Survived a mafia-style hit organized by his cousin. Was consulted by kings and politicians and mediated in war, and was expected to be a psychotherapist, community leader, as well as a spiritual teacher. So that was our beloved root teacher who was not a holier-than-thou type of teacher.
In a way, when I listen to you, Bonnie, another language for what, at least what I hear, or a language for what I hear in the stories and teachers that you spoke of is empowerment, that something in this mysterious process of teacher-student, both in Dharma and in other ways, yes, can be teaching or talking about or demonstrating, but in its most fundamental movement, it is an empowerment of someone else to find their own understanding like yours. Not identical, but in that same terrain. And over the course of these weeks, as we've talked about the factors of enlightenment and the spiritual faculties and the Brahmaviharas, when you first read them, they're lists. You know, the Buddha was a list maker, along with backaches and having Ananda teach for him and so forth. And they seem like good, you know, psychological list descriptions. But in fact, as you have practiced, and I've seen it in the people that I've talked to, you begin to inhabit and feel and experience and become empowered in yourself to know, oh, this is calm. This is faith. This is concentration. This is equanimity. This is compassion. And these qualities grow in you. And this becomes the environment, the holding environment for them to awaken in you. Ajahn Chah, I'll tell a couple of stories or a few stories from being with him, always wanted to put it back on others. He had a lot of people imagining great things about him. And when I was first studying with him, I would watch him really closely, like, okay, is this guy's enlightened? How is he behaving, right? And he would sit there and wipe his nose with his robe sometime, and I go, that doesn't look so enlightened. Or pick, and I think, was he being mindful when he did that? Is he mindful all the time? You know, because I was very young and kind of mindful all the time must be what enlightenment is, you know. Or he'd pick at his toes, or he'd you know, say something offhand. And then one day I was asking for some teachings from him, and he told me some things. And a while later, he told me something else that was completely different and inconsistent. And I got really frustrated. And I came to him because I was frustrated, and he told me to do this, but then you told me to do that, and I don't know what to do, you know.
And I said, I've been watching and you just, I have to say it, you don't seem that enlightened to me. It was good for a whole, that's just. And he, like you, he just laughed. He thought that was a great thing. I mean, I think I was the only Westerner there at that time. Maybe it was, maybe Sumedho had come back, you know. So I was a source of amusement for him anyway,
right?
And that was weird, weird white guy with ears that stuck out a lot, and, you know, a very big nose, you know, compared to the people. Oh my God, should I tell that story? No, I'll see. Am I? Just trying to find out if this is right speech or not. All right, I'll go on. Anyway, so he was really inconsistent, and I said, I I'm looking for how to behave and how to act and what enlightenment looks like. And you don't seem so enlightened to me in certain moments anyway. And he said, great. And I said, what do you mean great? You know, I was really frustrated. I was ready to leave. What do you mean that's good? He said, well, because if I fit your model, your idea, your ideal of enlightenment, you would actually think that it could be found out here. And it can't be. It's not out here. Which is to say, it's also not a matter of imitation. Nobody's ever been like you before. And so he went further. He said, as far as inconsistency goes, he said, there's a path that I know well, and I see other people walking down it, and sometimes they're about to fall on the ditch on the right-hand side, and I shout out, hey, go to the left, you know? And then that person wanders around for a while. They're about to fall off in the ditch and go some little sidetrack on the left, and I yell, hey, go to the right. He said, that's all I do in my teaching. I point them back to where they are, not where they're wandering to in some way. It's not about consistency. It's about coming to be in the reality of your own experience in the present. So he constantly both pointed us back to our own experience, and there's a way in which he demonstrated in a way, his wisdom was very simple. He'd come up to people, especially if you were having a hard time, he'd say, are you suffering? And either you'd say no, and he'd say, great, I hope you enjoy the day, right? And, or you'd say yes, and he'd say, oh, must be attached, and kind of smile and walk off. And he didn't see it. It wasn't like judgment that it was a bad thing or a good thing or something. He was just, that's how it is, you know? If you're suffering, you must be attached, and he'd smile. And he was obviously in a different place, you know? So anyway, there was a nun, a Westerner, who came to practice with Ajahn Chah. And she was quite charismatic. She was one of the first Western women to become a Thai-style nun in the forest monastery that he'd made, that they'd created for Westerners. And she was there for about 5 years, and a number of other women had come to practice there as well, but she was the most charismatic of them and the most senior. And then one day she said, I'm leaving, and she just left. And about a year later, she came back. It turned out she had thrown away her robes, and she had found a church, fundamentalist church, and she'd become a born-again Christian with a great kind of fundamentalist vision, and she'd found Jesus in a very important way for herself. She came back, and she stayed at the monastery, and she was trying to convert everybody and saying, you know, you're on the wrong path. And it's okay, this Buddhist stuff is all right, but Jesus is the way, you know? And she was very charismatic and very adamant, as fundamentalists of any kind can be. And people were getting really upset that she's here and she comes to visit when she doesn't stay here and she's, you know, and what do we do about this? And both the Westerners and the villagers who she knew, and she spoke, you know, the local language, and they were just really upset. What do we do? This woman, she was our heroine. We, you know, this great nun, and now she's telling us that Jesus is the way. And they were so upset, they all marched. It was about a 10-mile walk through the jungle as a group over to the main monastery to see Ajahn Chah. And sat down and told the story, and he knew she'd come back, but, you know, she's proselytizing and so forth, and, you know, what do we do about this? And he looked, he sat for a minute, he looked at me and said, well, maybe she's right. And that's all he said. And they went back, you know, that was his reply. And it was so beautiful because we get so caught in the views that we have about the way things are supposed to be. And his teaching was about the wisdom of not knowing, the wisdom of, I described the wisdom of insecurity. It was the wisdom of not clinging to views. You know, and everybody had, oh, she's threatening our views. Maybe she's right. It's just, you could feel in it the spaciousness. And he just offered that to everyone else. You know, you could put it down. It was really beautiful. I mean, I remember when I was quite sick as a monk in my little hut, I got malaria in the jungle in the forest, and I got wretchedly sick. And I was sort of lying on the floor of my little hut, a lot of fever, and Ajahn Chah came to visit me. And the Lao language is a very kind of simple farmer language, mostly very, the sentences are short and it's kind of straightforward. And culturally, it's a beautiful language. And he said, Ben Kai, which means got a fever. I said, yeah. Said, sick, huh? I said, yeah. He said, hurts a lot, huh? I said, yeah. He said, scary? I said, uh-huh. He said, makes you want to go home to your mother, doesn't it? I said, yes. He looked at me, he said, this is suffering. This is suffering. And he just looked at me, this is suffering. He just named it. And he said, you know, we've all had it. We've all suffered like this. We all had malaria. And there's better medicine than we did now. And he arranged for me to get medicine, but it took a couple of days for it to work. He said, and that's fine. You know, you live in the jungle, you get malaria, you get your medicine. This is suffering. This is the way that it is. And there was a certain way in which when he talked about it, that I felt that he had just been there as I had, and that he knew that I would be all right. And he didn't even say, you're going to be all right. He just said, yeah, this is it, isn't it? You know, that he had lived through it. And there is a kind of empowerment simply by his steadiness and his presence that, yes, anything can happen, and the Dharma that we practice can hold it all.
Bonnie, starting out with her first retreat, made me remember a story from my first retreat. It was a Zen retreat with my first teacher, the Korean Zen master, Daesan Sunim, and it was a three-day session, which was, you know, my first time and very intense to sit and walk constantly like that. And I think it was the second day. I can't remember if it was the second morning or the third, but I woke up, and this was at the Zen Center at that time, there wasn't room for all of us to sleep over. And I lived really close by, so I just ride my bicycle and sleep at home at night and then go back at, you know, 4 a.m. to start with our 108 prostrations and then the day of practice. So I actually woke up at home, and I was looking in the mirror in the bathroom, and I was kind of groggy, and I looked in the mirror and I saw this blackened corpse face, and I was terrified, actually. And I stopped looking in the mirror, and I just couldn't, you know, just that expression we had then, it blew my mind. And I was really eager to speak to him. We had a meeting each day, and I went in for my meeting, and you did your three prostrations, and then you sit down, and blurting, you know, look, this is what happened. I woke up in the morning, I looked in the mirror, and I saw it, and I looked like a corpse, and it was really scary, and what does this mean? And he just burst out laughing, which was a little bit not the response I had expected. I felt puzzled and perhaps slightly that he hadn't gotten it, how important and serious this was. And then he took his stick. He had a Zen teaching stick, and he just tapped me on the thigh, not hard. He just tapped me on the thigh, and he just laughed and said, "You're already a corpse."
Well, but it's just...
Thank you. Well, okay. So what he meant by that, you could take it any way you want to, because those teaching moments, what I received in that moment was a two-sided teaching. One that by sitting and getting so caught up in my mind and this story and describing the experience, I wasn't even with him. I wasn't present at all with him in that moment. So that was not an alive moment together. I was just... Blah, 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 blah. And the other thing I understood was he was also laughing because, yes, this is the way it is. Just by virtue of having this body, that's where it's headed. And I had had a glimpse of that. And then the next story that I wanted to share with you was another story, but very different, around the end of life. My teacher, Maureen Stewart Roshi, was really my heart teacher. That when I found her, met her in 1979, I just practiced with her until she died in 1990. And this story happened toward the end of her life. She was really sick at that point. And my then husband and I had gone over to help her, you know, make dinner and help her clean up. She was still at home, help her clean up her apartment. And so she was resting. It was this sort of multi-level townhouse apartment that she had, which you could always tell when you looked into. There were about three buildings. She had purple blinds, so you could always tell which one was hers by the purple blinds. And so she was resting on one of the levels, just slightly upstairs from where I was straightening up magazines on a table. She loved to cook, and she had this big pile of gourmet magazines. And so I was straightening up the magazines, and I really wanted to ask her. I knew this was coming to the end of her life, and I really wanted to ask her, well, actually about her enlightenment. What did she have? I was so curious, what was she feeling at this time herself? Because she was very strong and pretty equanimous, and, you know, you couldn't really tell. And I felt very close to her. We were like family in the way that you are when you do a lot of practice like this together. You're in silence, and you're, at least for the time of a retreat, you're living together and eating together and going through so much together. And my mind was very simple and trusting in the context of her. So I felt like I just really had to know, after all her years of Zazen, what was it like? What would be... I guess it was a little bit like Bonnie's question to Joseph, but I wasn't so much asking her to tell me personally what to do, so much as what is your wisdom at this time in your life? And it's a little bit scary to ask your spiritual teacher about the nature of her enlightenment toward, you know, the end of her life. But as I said, I felt very at ease with her. So it was just like being, you know, I called upstairs to her and asked her, you know, how is it for you right now? What would you say to me from this place where you are right now? And what she said was not, it was not at all what I expected to hear. She said, without hesitating, just three words, she said, "Live it up." live it up. If any of you, well, you are doing, you know, you're doing really intensive practice, sitting and walking and lots of renunciation and lots of going through difficult things and sitting through pain. And this was, we did this too. And this was what she taught us how to do. So I didn't really expect that answer, which to me had a kind of, we, you know, live out quality. I came to understand it as just live fully, live fully, live each moment to the hilt, that that's what she was saying. But she was also saying, live it up, live it up. But there's a little more, but I think I'm going to save that little more about this for my talk on Tuesday. But the last story, no, maybe two more, just quick ones. These are stories about trusting yourself. And one of them is from Upandita, Sayadaw Upandita, a great Burmese meditation master that I sat with about, I'm not sure, maybe 8 years ago. And it was the opening of the Forest Refuge in Massachusetts, the long-term retreat center. And first they had a retreat for teachers, and I sat that, and then they had a one-month retreat with Upandita. And I went in with some trepidation because he had this reputation for being such a fierce teacher, and I had been practicing a lot already before I went in for the meeting. And I reported to him, you're just really supposed to report about the rise and fall of the breath and what you've noticed about that. And you don't get to say anything about your feelings or, you know, anything like that. It's just, you know, reporting what you've learned from the rise and fall of the breath. So I reported what I had learned at that point from the rise and fall of the breath. And then I had, you know, just that wobble, that moment of doubt. And I sort of, after I said it, I kind of looked to him and was asking, is that enough? Or there was just this uncertainty. And he looked at me and said, why do you keep looking under the object, meaning the rise and fall of the breath, when you've already seen its true nature, that it rises and falls and appears and disappears and one breath is replaced by another and such things that we learn? And it was amazing because he summed up in that one question kind of my whole life of self-doubt in the Dharma. You know, why are you searching under something that you've already seen? So that was a very powerful and encouraged. It was kind of all downhill from there in some ways with him and me. But I did make him laugh once, which if you've ever sat with him, you know this is highly unusual, to the point where his other sayadaws were all talking about it. You made him laugh. I know. Now I have to tell you what made him laugh. Okay, so I will. I will. They were so, you know, I didn't know that it was that unusual that everybody would be talking about it, that he would, you know, crack a smile. But what we had to do was, you know, make this report each time we went in, and you were supposed to report what you had seen, you know, quite clearly and hopefully. And so I went in, I think it was the third time or something, for my report, and I reported what I had seen to him. And I reported several things I had seen. And it was kind of like Ajahn Chah. He sort of looked at me quizzically, like, aren't you suffering, or isn't, you know? And I said to him, I just sort of blurted out, listen, I'm obviously choosing the absolutely best experiences that I have to tell you about. And we went a little. I mean, were you going to go report your schleppy, mindless moment of wishing you could have dinner? And I mean, you know, no, you're going to tell him anyway. So that made him laugh. And he said, that was very honest, which kind of makes you wonder, what is everybody else telling him, right? But, and actually in that tradition, you can hear, the way it's set up is you can hear the person who comes, you know, whose meeting, anyway, it's not so helpful to hear people's meetings. You might think, you know, when you're sitting out there waiting for your meeting, kind of craning, can I catch a little bit of wisdom? It's actually not so helpful to hear other people's meetings, especially if the person who goes before you has a lot more experience than you've had with that tradition. And the last story is just a very simple story of my teacher, Koban Chino Roshi. And he didn't really call himself Roshi. He called himself Koban Chino Otagawa. Otagawa was his family name, and Chino was his master's name. And this was also the first retreat that I sat with Koban. It was a week, 7 days, Sashin. And you got one meeting with the teacher during the week. And he asked me a question when I came in. He said, what are you going to do when the last teacher is dead and there are none left? Who are you going to learn from then? And I reflected for a second. I thought this is such a great answer. And I said, I'm going to learn from everything. Everything will be my teacher at that point. And by the way, that's a very easy thing to say. It's really not so easy to live like that. But I said, everything will be my teacher. And he said, no. You will be. You yourself will be your teacher. So that's the theme, really, I think, from the thread that runs through our stories, is that theme of trust yourself, trust your experience, and work with the part of you that's looking for the enlightened teacher out there, or the perfect, you know, you can see into my heart. You know me better than I do. Tell me what is the best thing for me to do. We kind of long for somebody like that who would train us, know exactly. It's kind of like the perfect parent, if you think about it, but don't, because there isn't such a thing, you know. Our emotional needs will never have all been met by our parents. And once you've become a parent, you have more merciful attitude toward their parenting crimes, hopefully as well as your own. But, you know, the take-home teaching is that somehow sitting up straight in the midst of this imperfect life, imperfect self, imperfect, perfect present moment, that we learn to trust the Dharma as it unfolds in our own being, and how absolutely unmistakable that is. That whatever happens is not a mistake. I think that's a good stopping place. So we agreed that we would turn back to each other, but actually, do you want to add, Bonnie?
I wanted to add one other little story. I'm going to try to tell it quickly. In addition to this wonderful practice that I have a lot of confidence and faith, and I also was so lucky to actually do the Lakota Sundance for like 6 years. And during that, you know, I had actually come to the Sundance after I had done a lot of intensive Theravadan practice. So the first year I started, I said, okay, I'm going to do dancing meditation and I'm going to be mindful the whole time. And as soon as I got into the arbor, actually even before I got into the arbor, I tried to do walking meditation. And that ceremony refused to be anything else but for what it was. It did not allow me to do anything besides be present for the Sundance the way people experience that ceremony and get purified and get sanctified by it. And so I guess my point is that the same is true with the ceremony we're doing here. That, you know, if you can give yourself over to this practice, it'll take you where you're supposed to go. So that's my two cents about that.
And maybe I'll add one more little story. All of these are empowerment. Really expressing how you carry the Dharma, that the Dharma is within you. So some years ago when the Dalai Lama was here, sitting right where Bonnie is, looking happy as she does. We had a big meeting of Buddhist teachers from around the West for a number of days. And because the Dalai Lama is a head of state, even though it's in exile and such a significant figure, when he comes to the U.S., he gets a Secret Service detail to protect him. And they sent a lot of Secret Service. There was, I don't know, 40 Secret Service here or something like that. And they were having a good time. Mostly there are these like buff young guys and young women who are, they're very agile and attentive and whatever. And a bunch of them, when they first came, they said, so where can we rent horses around here? They decided they were going to guard the Dalai Lama by riding horses all around there. They were there having a good time, right? You know, and watching people come in and out. So but they were doing their job. Then they would escort him to this big house nearby where he stayed and come back here, and he stayed here, some he stayed there, and so forth. And when the event ended after a number of days, and the Dalai Lama was about to go off to the next teaching that he had to do, and we also had a whole group of 400 or 500 Tibetans from the Bay Area come and be with the Dalai Lama here. It was very beautiful. Anyway, before he left, the head Secret Service woman and some of the other kind of team leaders asked the Dalai Lama if they could have their picture taken with him. And of course, he's always amenable to that. You know, oh, don't you want to take my picture? Come on here, you know, and he'll hold their hands and everybody. And so here there were, you know, like 30, 40 of them all. And I was there and I started to talk to a couple of the ones who'd been doing this for a long time. And they said, you know, he's different. I said, what do you mean he's different? They said, we have guarded prime ministers and queens and kings and, you know, presidents and so forth. You know, all these people that are considered the most special personages, dignitaries to visit America, but the Dalai Lama is different. And I said, how is he different? And they were all smiling, grinning, being with him. They said, because he treats us as if we're special. And that's the difference, you know. And then you saw him like holding hands with different ones and getting their picture. They take their little phone out. And, oh, I want my picture with holding hands with the Dalai Lama. That he treats us as if we're special. And it was such a beautiful thing to see. Yeah, prime ministers, kings, whatever, queens. But this is different. And this is the empowerment that is given from the Dharma to each person because you are special. You are the Buddha in your own unique, beautiful, magnificent, troubled. What is that, Bonnie read? You got your back aches like the Buddha and some people around that are difficult as he did. But you awaken these qualities and you awaken to your own Buddha nature. And that's really the blessing of what we do together.
After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, It's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell.